I would like to move on to our first guest, which is Milan Ilnitsky. Thank you very much for joining us from 350.org Toronto. And we were going to be talking today a little bit about some of your campaigns. The first one, if you wanted to just introduce yourself a little bit and tell the audience a little bit about who you are first.
Certainly. Thank you for having me. So my name is Milan Ilnitsky. I'm a PhD student in political science at the University of Toronto and a junior fellow at Massey College. And I'm also the president of the Toronto 350.org chapter. We're a relatively new group. We were formed just this past summer, but we consist of a group of volunteers who are working to encourage the transition to a low carbon global economy in Toronto. So our two big campaigns at the moment, one of them is in relation to the Enbridge Line 9 pipeline, which the company is trying to reverse to carry diluted bitumen from the oil sands through the Toronto area. And the other is we're encouraging the University of Toronto to divest its portfolio from fossil fuels, starting with Shell.
All right. So let's start with the first one, then, a little bit about the Line 9 issue. One of the articles that we actually did an interview about with somebody a few weeks ago was based on an editorial that was in the Huffington Post where they where the argument was from our guest that essentially fighting individual pipelines, for instance, he was proposing was potentially the wrong fight and that we should be going after the oil industry in general. What are your thoughts on the success or failure or the effect of going after individual projects as potentially as opposed to attacking the oil industry as a whole? How do you feel about that sort of issue as far as tactics is concerned?
I think targeting individual pipelines has been quite effective so far. What it does is it introduces uncertainty into the development plans in the oil sands, whether they're actually going to be able to ship the product that they're hoping to produce. So by introducing uncertainty about the fate of projects like Keystone XL, which 350.org has worked on a great deal, the Northern Gateway Pipeline in British Columbia, projects like the reversal of the Line 9 pipeline, we can reduce the potential future export capacity. And given the unwillingness of the federal government and the government of Alberta to put meaningful limits on the release of greenhouse gas emissions, at this stage, blocking pipeline construction is one of the more effective tactics we have available to us.
All right. So talk a little. You said it's been able to produce uncertainty and that it's been successful. Can you talk about some of the other issues that you've seen some success with?
In terms of the pipeline?
With as far as like pipeline or just blocking specific projects in general. And has this something that you've seen success with and that's why you're following that model?
Well, you can look at the Keystone XL example, which is in many ways a big surprise. I think there was an expectation that the Obama administration would approve it with relatively little consideration. But there has been this huge public outcry and people sort of raising the big question, which is about the future of our energy system. And are these the kind of investments we ought to be making for the next 50 years or the next 100 years? Should we, given what we know about climate change now, be effectively doubling down on fossil fuels? Or should we be investing in alternatives?
Mm. So one of the criticisms that was made, just speaking of Keystone XL for a minute, was that we had the news story that came out, would have been a couple of years now, about some massive protests. I believe Bill McKibben was at it. There was a massive protest on Capitol Hill a couple of years ago, Keystone, and then U.S. President Obama stopped considering the bill. We put in the context on this program of him basically punting the decision until after the election. At the time, it was considered a victory, however, and everybody was celebrating. We now see that this project, as predicted, may have simply been punted. But we saw an article come out a few weeks ago. I'm not sure if it was last week or the week before, about Jim Flaherty actually expressing public concern about Obama's conviction to finishing that pipeline. From what you've seen, what is your personal opinion on both the project that you're working on, how confident are you that you might be able to stop the Line 9 reversal, and then as well other projects like Keystone? How are you thinking? Is public opinion and pressure building enough that these projects will actually be stopped? How successful do you think you're going to be able to be?
Well, I can tell you a bit about the history of Keystone XL and 350.org. I was there in Washington, D.C. in August of 2011 when the first big Keystone protest took place. I believe it was the largest act of climate-related civil disobedience in American history up to that point, with more than 1,200 people getting arrested in front of the White House to protest this pipeline. And so it did result in the delay of this decision. The pipeline needs approval from the State Department because it crosses an international frontier. So we are actually going back to Washington, D.C. next weekend for February 17th for President's Day. About 8 of us from Toronto350.org will be participating in another protest, this one perhaps even larger, again calling on the president to reject this particular proposal.
With the amount of investment that, I mean, that's already been done, we did another interview with the southern half, a gentleman that, from Texas, actually, that was protesting the already largely implemented southern component of the pipeline. Do you not feel like perhaps that at this point that so much has already been invested that it's unlikely that this will happen, or do you really think that the Keystone can be stopped?
I think with the investments we're making in fossil fuel infrastructure, we're kind of setting ourselves up to pay three times. We're building the wrong infrastructure, and at some point not too far in the future, we're going to realize the seriousness of climate change and realize how inappropriate it is for us to be building all this oil, gas, and coal infrastructure. So then we'll have less time to build appropriate energy infrastructure, which will increase the costs of doing so, and we'll have to deal with more climate change, so our adaptation costs will increase. Mm. So we're really setting ourselves up to pay three times.
So your position is that despite all the money that's been spent, it will be even more expensive to not continue. You don't agree with the point of no return of investment on that point?
Well, the big economic issue when it comes to fossil fuels is that those who are producing and using them are considering only the immediate economics. You know, I can produce a barrel of oil for this cost and I can travel this far in this vehicle with it. But what they're not considering is the long-term impact that arises from the greenhouse gas pollution that inevitably results when you burn fossil fuels. And the greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere now are going to persist for thousands of years. They're going to raise sea levels and cause all kinds of global disruption. And all of those costs really need to be factored into the calculation. And when you factor those costs in, fossil fuels just don't make sense at this point.
Mm. So if those numbers are solid, then how does it stand to convince government to take action on this? I mean, if there is, as you say, solid numbers and solid science behind the risks of climate change and the ideas about how to delay the effects or reduce the effects, how does that get translated into policy? How do we get, if those facts are true, how do we convince government to act on those facts?
It's a big challenge. And one of the reasons why it's challenging is because of the time horizons that governments think across. Governments are thinking about maybe the next 3 to 5 years, whereas we need to be thinking about the impact that our choices are going to have over decades and centuries in the future. If we keep doing what we're doing now, we're setting ourselves up to disintegrate the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets and significantly raise global sea levels with all sorts of other international climatic effects. So we need governments to pay attention to those long-term impacts. And one of the ways to do that is by encouraging institutions that have a longer-term perspective, like universities, which are thinking decades and centuries into the future, to start thinking about what they can do to help aid this transition to a low-carbon global economy.
So as we mentioned at the top of the hour there, 350, you're part of 350 Toronto, which is part of a large organization, Bill McKibben's 350.org. Perhaps, you know what, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, before we get to that, let's just confirm that everybody understands the significance of the 350 number. Why is it called 350.org?
350 refers to the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution, so before about 1750, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere was about 280 parts per million. And we've now increased it to about 393 parts per million, and we're adding 3 parts per million every year. And the higher that number goes, the more total climatic damage the world is going to suffer, and the higher the risk that we're going to encounter these tipping points, whereby we induce large permanent changes in the climate system. And there are tipping points that can themselves cause further warming. For instance, if we cause the Arctic permafrost, which contains vast quantities of methane, to melt, that can cause warming over and above what we're causing through fossil fuels. So the 350 target relates to the level of warming which maybe avoids the most dangerous possible impacts of climate change. If we can stabilize the atmospheric concentration at 350 parts per million, we're unlikely to see more than 2 degrees Celsius of warming globally, and we're unlikely to see some of the really scary tipping points take place.
Right. And so as you already outlined, just to emphasize, we are in fact at this point past that number.
We are, but if we were to aggressively curtail global greenhouse gas emissions, it's still possible to get back below 350 parts per million because the oceans have a capacity to absorb carbon dioxide. So if we just stopped emitting greenhouse gases today, much of what's in the atmosphere now would enter into the oceans. So by adopting an appropriate mitigation pathway, it's still possible for us to achieve the 350 target, though it requires significantly more energetic action on the part of governments around the world than we've seen so far.
So kind of a way to describe that effect would be like kind of like if you had a frying pan on the stove and you turn down the heat a little bit, the frying pan doesn't immediately change the new heat, but it sort of edges in that direction. And so that's what we're looking at. By reducing the gases in the atmosphere, it'll slowly edge back in the direction of the climate that we're used to, basically, is how that works. Yeah?
Basically, we can think about two huge stocks of carbon, one of which has already been added to the atmosphere, and one of which resides in the coal, oil, and gas reserves that exist around the world. And if we choose to burn all of those reserves, we'll dramatically increase the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. We'll take ourselves to over 1,000 parts per million, and maybe 5.5 or 6 degrees Celsius of global temperature increase. So at this point, the real challenge is to keep as much of that carbon as possible underground.
Okay, so getting to where I was going to go with that question originally, as we started, the 350 Toronto is a local chapter of a larger organization. One of the issues that we've talked about many times on this program with the difficulty in interacting or trying to lobby as a citizen, your federal government, is that a lot of their decisions are, obviously, you're only one of their inputs. You know, ideally, you're their input. They're there as, you know, public servant, and you should be their only concern. But in reality, we all know that that's not true. They have investors and financiers and backers and oil. There's also other governments, right? We live in a globalized world now, so they have to negotiate with other governments. You know, Canadian government's concerned about things like free trade with the U.S., NAFTA agreements, and all sorts of stuff like that. So when we're talking about that, a lot of the issues at global climate talks that we've talked about before are issues about getting various countries to agree on stuff, and that has been the biggest problem with moving forward. For instance, the U.S. being able to come to some sort of agreement with China about who should pay the costs. You know, the people who industrialized first or the people who are putting the majority of the pollutants into the air now. So how do we arrange that? Seeing as a larger whole, your organization really is looking at this on a global level. How do you interact on a global level? Is this a variety of ways of various groups, various 350 groups in various countries interacting with their own governments simultaneously? Or how's the way forward as far as getting governments to cooperate with other governments to get this stuff done?
Well, despite how the long-term impacts of climate change unfold over decades and centuries, the decisions we make in the next few years are going to be absolutely critical for determining which pathway the world ends up on. And as a consequence, it's necessary to take action essentially at every level. And that's what 350.org and other organizations are doing. We're not restraining ourselves to lobbying national governments. We're looking at provincial governments, municipal governments, at private corporations, at institutions like the University of Toronto. All of these organizations have a role to play in the transition that the world needs to achieve, and we're trying to use creative strategies to encourage that transition.
Okay, so let's take a pause there from the Line 9 kind of bigger climate change issue, and let's get down to the issue of University of Toronto. As we've been over a couple of times now, you're the local chapter. There are other chapters inside of Canada. Listeners from our program are listening from all over the country, so you can sort of answer in a generalized sense for our national audience. But can you talk a little bit about exactly what it is that you're trying to do? What does divestment mean, and how does that apply to something like a university? What is their role in how they affect climate change at a local level?
So the university has large investments, both in terms of their endowment and in terms of pension funds. And at the moment, many of those investments are in fossil fuel companies. Now, one thing to be aware of is if you look at a company like Shell or Exxon, their market value is based on the assumption that they're going to be able to burn the reserves of coal, oil, and gas that they own. But what we know from climate science is that we just can't burn that quantity of fossil fuels. And as a consequence, a lot of the apparent value of these companies is illusory. So we're calling on the University of Toronto to divest its portfolio from fossil fuel stocks, beginning with Shell. Shell is actually the university's largest investment. They have about $10 million invested. And as you probably know, Shell is now investigating drilling for oil in the Arctic. So they're taking advantage of the climate change that's already taken place in order to cause even more climate change. Mm-hmm. So again, it's about this transition, and it's about what kind of future do we want and what kind of investments will get us there, and continuing to invest in fossil fuels just won't do it. So by redirecting investment, we can aid the transition, and also the university can protect itself from some of the risks associated with how the value of these companies depends on this assumption that they're going to be able to continue to use the atmosphere as a free dumping ground for greenhouse gas pollution, which may just prove to be untrue in the medium term.
As someone that's done a little bit of study themselves, I took some classes specifically on climate change science. So I'm not an expert by any means, but I'm an educated novice on the issue of climate science. And one of the things that I can tell you right away is that it's a very complex issue. A lot of the questions don't have easy answers. It's something that very much similar to when we talk about the issues around nuclear power here on the program. Is that there's lots of people on lots of side because it's a complex issue. There's no kind of easy way to explain everything. I find it very understandable years ago how a lot of people could be confused about how climate change works or doubt that it existed because it's such a complex issue, right? And it's so easy to find ways that to think, well, that doesn't matter because of this. But you have to really understand the really heavy details of how it works. So we live in a time when I get frustrated when I meet someone that doesn't, you know, understand the basics of climate change or understand the gravity of the risks. However, when you look at things like, for instance, one of the things I remember from a Bill McKibben video that I watched was him talking about, you know, why are we even exploring drilling for more oil and gas? We can't afford to put the carbon in the atmosphere from the stuff that we already have on hand. So how can we do it? So, I mean, I think that's one of the issues is that, you know, for a lot of people, they're like, well, how can the climate change alarmists, quote unquote, be right about this? Because if that was true, we wouldn't be digging more oil and gas, right? If there was solid science saying that we couldn't afford to burn any more, we couldn't afford to burn what we've already got, much less drill more, then why would governments be drilling more? So can you comment a little bit on just like the people that you meet when you talk to people on the street or when you're just sort of dealing with people who aren't necessarily part of our, like, you know, we spend way too much time reading environment news type crowd. How do you communicate this information to someone that maybe doesn't have the science background and maybe is a little bit skeptical, you know, not for ideological reasons, but just purely out of the fact that they're misinformed or badly informed about these issues? How do we convince those people that this is a real issue?
Certainly. Well, the science of climate change, I agree with you, it's very complicated. And we have, you know, 50 or 60 years of major research being done on it. But what that research shows and what we can now be very confident about is some of the key dynamics of the climate system. And the key dynamic is when you add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, you cause the planet to warm. And we've already added a dangerous amount of CO2 to the atmosphere. And if we continue to behave the way we're behaving now, we're going to see serious impacts. And if we want to avoid those impacts, we need to curtail our use of fossil fuels. And there's no scientific doubt about those key dynamics. Like specific questions, like exactly what kind of climate impact will a particular region experience? Or exactly where will we see particular tipping points manifesting themselves? There's substantial research still being done on questions like that. But in terms of humanity's future with fossil fuels, we have a clear answer. We have the answer that if we continue to use fossil fuels as the basis of the global energy system, we're going to experience a dangerous amount of climate change.
So with the idea of divestment campaigns specifically, one of the things that we sort of talked about before the show was the idea that you're not simply advocating about taking money away from places. Because, I mean, that sort of seems like if someone was to look at that, you know, just like, oh, well, you know, you're just trying to, you know, affect where, you know, take money away from people you don't agree with. But it's not really that. What you're talking about is almost less divestment and more reinvestment. You're interested in taking money away from oil and gas to put it into renewables. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy of what type of investments you are interested in making?
Well, one curious thing about the energy system is that people don't tend to have direct engagement with it. It doesn't matter that much practically whether your refrigerator is running on energy from coal or oil or gas or nuclear or solar or wind. So effectively what we need to do is take the global economy, which is currently kind of propped up and supported by fossil fuel energy, and shift to a situation where it's being supported by the renewable forms of energy that we can rely on indefinitely. So there are kind of two components within the economy. There are all the parts that we rely upon that, you know, people work at and that supply us with what we need to stay alive. And then there's the current energy basis that's supporting that economy. And what we need to do is replace the energy basis. So we're saying don't invest in the forms of energy from the past that have no future, but maintain your investments in the economy as a whole and invest in the forms of energy that can continue to support that indefinitely. Like, what's kind of exciting about the transition to renewable energy is that since the Industrial Revolution, we've been relying on these fuels that are inevitably going to be depleted and that cause all kinds of additional harm just by using them in terms of the toxic pollution that fossil fuel use produces. But once we build a sustainable global economy, it will be able to function indefinitely, and we'll have a society that runs on sunlight and wind and which we can perpetuate forever.
So we're just pretty much out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us, but I do have one final question, which is sort of my fun question that I sarcastically like to ask as many people as I possibly can, which is that the Green Majority is on a mission to find out exactly why there are oil subsidies. I have not yet, but to date, Kevin, am I wrong? Nobody's given us a good reason.
No, not even an inkling.
No, I mean, I've been trying, perhaps, you know, to be honest and to be fair, all kidding aside for a minute, we've of course been asking all the people on our team, as it were. So I mean, perhaps we're asking the wrong people, but do you have any proposal at all as to even cynically as to why oil subsidies exist? Why do we as Canadian citizens, many of us who are having trouble paying our rent and keeping jobs and getting food on the table during the tough economic times, why are we handing money from our paychecks to the richest companies on the planet? Do you have any explanation for that at all?
Well, there are many types of oil subsidies, ranging from the most direct to the most indirect. The most direct are maybe reduced prices for heating oil or gasoline, which exist in some countries. And you can see why those are popular with consumers. And other forms of subsidies include reduced taxed bills or special treatment for investment. But really, the big subsidy is ignoring the costs associated with pollution. That's the kind of big subsidy that society as a whole and governments are giving to fossil fuel companies. And the reasons why those subsidies exist are because some of them are directly popular, like reduced costs for fossil fuels for consumers. Some of them serve influential corporations that have political clout. And because we just haven't yet taken into account those real pollution costs and created systems of governance that will get them under control.
So in Canada, I'm sorry, I don't have the exact number handy, but when we're talking about oil subsidies, all the companies combined, oil and gas and everything, and you add up the kind of the whole fossil fuel economy in Canada, we're in the billions of dollars of subsidies. What you're saying, though, is that there's additionally even more that we're not putting into those numbers. Those numbers could theoretically double or triple because we're not accounting for the costs of doing business, because those have been externalized and not accounted for. If you had to ballpark, how much higher than what is being accounted for would the costs of the negative repercussions be?
Well, in some ways, I think it's even misleading to talk about the costs of climate change exclusively in terms of dollars. Like, if we disintegrate the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets, that over the course of centuries would raise global sea levels by 14 meters. That's destroying New York City and London and the Netherlands and Bangladesh. And you can talk about those costs in terms of dollars or in terms of the risk associated for the rest of the university's investment portfolio from causing that sort of damage. But think about the human suffering. Think about how these are areas that have been inhabited for all of human civilization and the risks that we're imposing on future generations. And in some ways, I think the costs are much more moral than economic.
Mm. So, you know, quite literally wiping ourselves off the map.
Certainly significant parts of the inhabited world.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Milan Ilnitsky from 350toronto.org. Would you like to give people some information if they're interested in finding your group or any of the other local groups in Canada, contact information, anything you'd like to give to our listeners?
So people anywhere can look at 350.org, 350.org, which is the main website for the organization. People in Toronto can look at our site, which is toronto350.org. We have meetings every Tuesday night from 7 to 9, so if you're interested, please come out.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you getting through the snow here to get to the station today, so thanks so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you for having me.